This is The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick, sitting in for John Hockenberry. Well, as President Obama travels through Senegal and South Africa, the Senate has been busy at home. It's passed the first major immigration reform bill in decades.
Here in America, those who once had no hope will give their kids the chance at a life they always wanted for themselves. Here in America, generations of unfulfilled dreams will finally come to pass.
We'll have more on the future of immigration reform later this hour, and we'll go to Mora County, New Mexico, the first county in the country to ban hydraulic fracking. But first, President Obama lands in South Africa today for a trip focused on trade and investment relations.
The fact of the matter is that Africa oftentimes is not focused on by our press and our leadership back home unless there's a crisis. And part of the reason why we want to focus here, starting in Senegal, is to make sure people understand there is enormous potential here.
Now, this might surprise you, though. Not everyone in these countries is so excited about President Obama's trip. In South Africa, trade union, student, academic, and Muslim groups are organizing what they hope will be a mass protest at the U.S. Embassy in Pretoria. Lerato Mbele is a South African journalist and co-host of BBC's Newsday. She joins us from Johannesburg to discuss President Obama's mixed reception there and how it compares to the Obama mania just 5 years ago. Welcome, Lerato.
Thanks for having me.
Of course. Thanks for being with us. So I mentioned some of the groups that are participating in these protests, but it seems like a wide range of grievances. Has President Obama to these South African groups just become sort of a focus for lots of different forms of grievance?
I think that's a fair comment to make. When President Obama was elected 2008, there was massive euphoria across Africa and indeed here in South Africa because people saw it as highly momentous and symbolic that the United States had elected the first African American to be their 44th president and a man of African descent, and obviously there was carriage onto the African continent. They thought that that would put African issues onto the front burner in American foreign policy. It would predicate a lot of issues around economic development, progress, healthcare, free trade, the kinds of things that matter to Africa as it raises its profile in international relations. That hasn't happened, and there's a grave sense of disappointment. But not only that, he hasn't put Africa front and center of his foreign policy, but that he's continued very much on the tack of former U.S. presidents with heavy engagement in the Middle East, issues around nuclear proliferation and talking around global security, the kinds of issues that do matter on a global scale, but don't matter on a unique and individual scale in Africa. So there is a sense that he's been a bit of a disappointment, even though he can argue that American national interests required him to behave in a particular way, and his project was unity and reconciliation inside of the United States, and it couldn't have been a broader African agenda. There is a sense that Barack Obama hasn't delivered maybe on the aspirations of Africa's people, if not the promises that he overtly made to Africa's people. And issues around Guantanamo Bay, which you've mentioned, issues around prying by the intelligence community, are things that Democrats in Africa understand as violations of civil liberties. And, you know, in Africa, we're very big on civil liberties because South Africa, very much our identity is predicated on those kinds of values.
Lerato Mbele, the president also lands in South Africa at a time when there's already a huge media crush there, of course, gathering around what may be the final days of Nelson Mandela. Now, the president has met Nelson Mandela, but never as president, and has said that he would like to see the former South African leader and Nobel Prize winner while he's still president. This probably represents amazing logistical and security problems, but also privacy issues for the family, which are already sort of upset about all the media attention. Is that a visit that may happen between the two leaders?
Well, in defense of President Obama, he has shown some sort of recognition about the general invasion of privacy for the Mandela family, and I don't think he wants to be caught in the media frenzy. A press briefing that was conducted by South Africa's Minister of Foreign Affairs, which is the equivalent of the U.S. Secretary of State, to the media, stated categorically and unequivocally that Mr. Obama had abandoned plans to see Mr. Mandela in hospital. And I think the presidential team on the U.S. side really do see it as a logistical issue, but they also are are very sensitive to the cultural nuances that the visit would bring upon the family. So at this stage, from what we know, Mr. Obama will not be visiting Mr. Mandela. Nonetheless, he has paid tribute and homage to Mr. Mandela. This was during a press briefing that he conducted in Senegal, the first leg of his trip, where he called Mandela his personal hero and somebody whose life story is what got him involved in the anti-apartheid movement in the late 1970s. So very much Obama basically saying that Mandela's ideals, his humanitarianism, his ideals on reconciliation, on forgiveness, but on equal rights for all, is very much an ideology that shaped him as a leader. And to that extent, he's glad to have met Mandela in 2006 when he was senator of the state of Illinois, and he's happy to reside and preside on that memory and not intrude any further. So from what we know, there's not going to be a visit.
All right. Well, even if there is a great deal of disappointment in the presidency of Barack Obama in South Africa, there's no escaping the fact that this is a moment when one of the great civil rights leaders of the world, Nelson Mandela, may be in his final days, and the first black president of the United States is in the country at the very same time. It is quite a moment. Lerato Mbele, co-host of BBC's Newsday, thank you.
Thank you.
Well, back here at home in Washington, Congress is one step closer to adopting the most significant immigration overhaul in decades. Yesterday, the Senate passed Senate Bill 744 with bipartisan support, the kind rarely seen on Capitol Hill these days. 14 Republicans joined Democrats to support that bill. But here's a question. How many senators voted yes because they know that Senate bill will never become law? Now that bill is headed to the Republican-controlled House, where Speaker John Boehner has promised the House will reply with a bill of its own. It will not vote on the Senate bill, he says. And we already know that that House bill will be far different. But Diana Furchgott-Roth is a senior fellow at the Manhattan Institute and former chief economist in the Bush U.S. Department of Labor from 2003 to 2005, thinks the economic benefits of the Senate plan may be too good to pass up. And she joins me now. Hi, Diana.
It's great to be with you.
Thanks for joining us. We've heard during the debate how the Senate bill cuts the debt and may grow the economy, just in the most general terms. Is that what you like best about the bill? Explain how that works.
Well, it works because if we have more immigrants, we have more people who can work here, then our economic growth rises, just as the way if someone were to come and sprinkle a lot more factories over the United States, everyone would say, great, we're going to have more production. Well, if we have more labor in the United States, we also have more production. And immigrant labor complements the skills of the U.S. workforce. So the skills of native-born Americans are in a bell-shaped curve. We don't have many adults without high school diplomas. We don't have many adults with PhDs in math and science. But the skills of immigrants tend to be in a U-shaped curve. There are adults without high school diplomas, adults with PhDs in math and science, and that complements the skills of the native-born workforce, making our economy more efficient. So, and for example, if we can hire more immigrants at low wages, we might embark on more certain projects. That results in hiring of more native-born Americans as well as immigrants.
So
and if some bright... Yes?
Well, it sounds like what you're saying is that the specific part of the Senate bill, the biggest sort of most publicized part, which is the 13-year pathway to citizenship or at least legalization in this way, is the most important part, so that the 11 million people who are undocumented can work legally, and therein lies the economic benefit. Do I have that right, that it's the pathway to legalization that's the most important part as far as you're concerned?
It's not just the pathway to legalization. It's the fact that we'll be bringing in more people on H-1B visas, more high-skill workers who are on the H-1B visas, more low-skill workers on the W visas, more agricultural workers. We'll be able to not only provide documentation to the people who are here right now who don't have such documentation, but we will also be able to bring in more people. There's a global race for talent. We have a global economy. We want everybody, we want the brightest people to come here to the United States. We don't want to be giving someone a degree, for example, and telling them they have to go home. We want someone who's graduated from the leading universities all over the world to want to come here to the United States to work. The bill makes it easier for them to do that. That's what I like about the bill.
At the same time, as you know, there is a lot of concern, both on sort of the liberal wing of the Democratic Party and even in the conservative wing of the Republican Party in this last debate, that U-shaped curve that you talked about leads to a driving down of wages for American workers. You flood the market with people willing to work for less, and wages are driven down for everybody. Isn't that a risk also?
So that looks on the economy as basically a fixed pie, just the way in France they said no one could work more than 35 hours, because if they worked more than 35 hours, there wouldn't be enough work for everybody, and we have to share it. Immigrants who come here, they don't just work. They also buy things. They go to restaurants. They buy homes. They increase the demand for other kinds of goods also. And this economic activity results in greater growth. So if you look at Charleston, South Carolina, and New York, at the end of the 1700s, they were practically equivalent in terms of importance in the United States. But New York had far more immigrants. That made New York into the financial center, the megalopolis it is today, whereas Charleston, which had fewer immigrants, remains a smaller town in importance. So basically, having immigrants expands the economic pie because they have a demand for goods and services, and that increases work for native-born Americans also.
Well, Diana Furchtgott-Roth, in the minute we have left, you worked in the administration of George W. Bush. He was pro-immigration reform, and your argument kind of points up the division in the Republican Party right now. The Chamber of Commerce, the manufacturers, the agribusiness, business interests want this bill, and what used to be called nativists, essentially, people who want less immigration, don't want it. It's going to be interesting to see which side wins out here.
It really is, and we've always had nativists. You know, there were people who were against Italian immigrants, German immigrants. Now those are the good immigrants. And just as there have been always people who have been against immigration, I think we've shown that immigration grows the United States, improves everyone's skills, and makes everybody better off.
Diana Furchtgott-Roth, senior fellow at the Manhattan Institute and former chief economist in the U.S. Department of Labor under President George W. Bush. Thank you so much.
It's great to be with you.
NSA leaker Edward Snowden is still in limbo in a Moscow airport transit zone. He's been there since Sunday, waiting the fate of his application for asylum to Ecuador. Meanwhile, President Obama told reporters yesterday that the U.S. is not taking any drastic measures to bring Snowden back to the U.S. to face charges.
No, I'm not going to be scrambling jets to get a 29-year-old hacker.
Well, technically, Snowden isn't 29 anymore. He turned 30 last week. But there are much bigger questions at stake here.
What I'm really focused on is making sure, number one, that we are doing everything we can to prevent the kind of thing that happened at the NSA from happening again.
Now, the president may be focused on stopping leaks, and indeed a lot of the news media covering the story is focused on stopping the leaks. But a lot of Americans still have questions about what those leaks had to say about NSA surveillance programs, the very ones that Ed Snowden brought to light. Well, with us is Senator Angus King. He sits on the Senate Select Committee on Intelligence. Hello, Senator.
Hey, how are you? Nice to see you, Todd.
As I said, a lot of the media is focused on stopping leaks, and obviously the President of the United States, as we would imagine, wants to stop leaks. How well informed, given what you know about the two NSA programs that we know about, the telephone metadata and the internet surveillance of Facebook and Google and GChat and Skype, how well informed do you think the American public is now about the amount of surveillance that they are subjected to?
Well, I think they're reasonably well informed, although the way you just stated it was might contribute to the confusion. The latter case, the internet, is solely a program focused on foreigners. That's the authorization. That's the way it's designed. That's the way it's used.
But not if those foreigners come in contact with Americans, though. That's
well,
part of the
yes,
problem.
Well, yes, and so there are going to be those kinds of contacts. But that's really the focus of the program. There's this impression that somebody is sitting listening to every email and conversation that you and I have, and that's not true.
Senator Angus King is an independent senator from Maine. He joins us from Brunswick on the line. Senator, you sit on the Intelligence Committee, and one of the things that has come out of these revelations from Ed Snowden, these leaks, is how the Intelligence Committee operates, indeed how well-informed members of Congress are about programs like this. And we all expect members of the Intelligence Committee to be better informed than a rank-and-file member, but there's been quite a bit of reporting about how difficult it is, even for someone like you on the Intelligence Committee, to get specific answers to questions from briefers, and if you're not informed, the American public can't be informed, and that you can't legislate properly to stop a program you don't like or expand a program that you do. How well informed do you think you were about these programs before they came to light?
Well, it's a little I'm not the precise person to ask that question to because I wasn't on the committee until this January. My impression from talking to other senators who either had been on the committee or in the Senate was that there was debate about this. There was knowledge of what the outlines of the programs were, what the authorizations were, and that there was some pretty vigorous argument about it.
Meanwhile, Senator Ron Wyden from Oregon, who you know well and is one of the senior members of your committee, has complained bitterly that, yes, he knew about some of these programs, but that committee rules, even on certain things that weren't classified, prevented he or his staff from discussing it with anyone. And he feels like he couldn't legislate because there could be no public debate about some of these things. I know that you've heard those complaints. And so part of the question is whether people knew about things or not is one thing. Whether they can actually debate them and legislate is quite another.
Well, that's a really good point. And I really like Ron Wyden, and I think he's raised some very important points. This is tough stuff. I mean, this is sort of a classic dilemma facing governments and citizens for 1,000 years. And, you know, the fundamental role of government is to provide security. In the Constitution, the preamble, it talks about to ensure domestic tranquility and provide for the common defense. That's one of the reasons we form governments in the first place. The problem becomes you want a strong government to be able to protect you, but how are you protected from the government itself that you've created?
Well, meanwhile, Senator Angus King, Ed Snowden remains at large in Russia, as we mentioned. What do you think? Is it time to give up on him if he's going to head to Ecuador? Are we focused on the wrong thing and just sort of let him stay out there like Julian Assange? Should we be focused on him?
I think he ought to have to stay in the Moscow airport forever. I think that's a fitting fate for this guy.
Well, in terms of practicality, though, are we going to be able to get him back? Should we?
Well, I think we should exercise whatever legal authorities. I think the president is right. We're not going to send a SEAL team in or something. But if there's a legal way to use the extradition process, I think we should. I mean, this guy, I've been thinking about this as the story has unfolded. And at first I thought, well, you know, he's trying to raise a public debate about important issues, and, you know, maybe he's more like a whistleblower. But I'll tell you, Todd, as it's gone on, I'm moving more and more over toward the treason end of the scale. It was one thing. Number one, there were other ways he could have brought this information to light. He could have gotten in touch with Ron Wyden, for one thing, who's very publicly been interested in this, or other members of the Senate or House Intelligence Committee. He could have gone to the Inspector General. There are a number of ways he could have raised the kind of concerns that he was talking about at first, about Americans' privacy. But then he goes to China and publicly talks about what our cyber efforts are with regard to China, and that's a whole different deal. And now we learned, he gave an interview to the South China Post where he said that he took the Booz Allen job specifically to get in a position
to
get this information so he could release it.
Right.
That sounds like treason to me.
The chairman of your committee, Senator Dianne Feinstein, certainly agrees with you there. Senator Angus King, while I have you here, I want to ask you about student loans, because federally backed student loan rates are about to expire in the next couple of days. There's no agreement in Congress. You were part of a bipartisan group that tried to strike a deal here to keep rates going, at least temporarily, and Democrats rejected it. Democrats seem divided on this. Is there going to be a solution to prevent college loan rates, these Stafford loans, from going up?
Well, I hope so, because there is a solution out there, and Joe Manchin and I and a group of Republicans, also Tom Carper of Delaware, have put something forward that we think makes sense even outside of the context of this crisis about how to solve this. And I think as they look at the facts and there may be some movement toward some kind of compromise. By the way, what we're proposing is pretty close to what the president proposed. It's pretty close to a bill already passed in the House. So
indeed.
I think there's a solution out there, but we just got to Congress. We got to get to the precipice, and then maybe a little bit more. By the way, Todd, did you do your book report before Sunday night? I mean,
right. I understand what you're saying.
To put these things off.
Well, Senator Angus King, you're an independent, and you're new, and you might be forgiven for thinking that coming up with a bipartisan plan with five or six senators from both parties would solve a problem in the Senate. That's a student loan plan that the White House came up with that Democrats absolutely hate. So we'll see if there's a solution over the next couple of weeks. Senator Angus King, independent from Maine, joining us on the line. Thank you, Senator.
Hey, thanks, Todd. Good to talk to you.
Welcome back to The Takeaway. We go to the United Kingdom now, where the government is getting set to approve a new in vitro fertilization procedure. It's called mitochondrial transfer. And here's the thing. It gives babies created through IVF genetic material not from two parents, which is normal, but from three different parents. Two parents and a donor, really. Doug Turnbull is director of Wellcome Trust Center for Mitochondrial Research at Newcastle University in the UK. He pioneered this new IVF procedure, and he joins me now from his office in Newcastle. Hi, doctor.
Hi.
Thanks for being with us. So mitochondrial transfer, you're doing this procedure to prevent genetic diseases, as I understand it, right? These are diseases like muscular dystrophy, other diseases that are carried in the mitochondrial DNA.
Yes. Mitochondria are like the powerhouses of batteries and cells, and they generate the energy that cells need, whether it be muscle, whether it be heart, whether it be brain. And the patients who have these mitochondrial diseases effectively run out of energy. And this can produce very severe diseases that you've already mentioned and can lead to early death.
So once you've identified that an embryo, a baby, might be at risk of inheriting one of these diseases, describe for us in terms that we can understand about how you combine, I guess, good mitochondrial DNA to replace the bad?
Yeah. Doctors like me look after large families of patients who carry these mutations. So these mutations are well described, and women that carry these mutations are clearly at risk of having severely affected offspring. So what we are proposing and other people are proposing to do is transfer the nuclear DNA, and the nuclear DNA is a DNA that carries the vast majority of our genes. So the genes that make you or me, are in that nuclear DNA. And we proposing to transfer those nuclear genes from an egg, either just before fertilization or just after fertilization, from an egg that contains unhealthy mitochondria with a mutation to an egg from another woman that's got healthy mitochondria. Thus, the baby that would be subsequently born would have all the nuclear characteristics, all the characteristics you would expect, but would have healthy mitochondria. And those healthy mitochondria would be derived from another woman.
Which is to say that you wouldn't have a baby that's a sort of composite of three parents, as we would think, hair color and eye color, but just the small mitochondrial part. And Dr. Turnbull, I know you're familiar with the criticism here, and of course it might come as something expected. You're creating an embryo essentially for spare parts is the ethical concern of some of your opponents here, that you're not creating an embryo that is strictly from two parents and you're sort of creating a hybrid embryo that's for medical parts.
Yes, and clearly there is, some people have very strong views on this, and I respect those views. We know that in the UK those views represent about 1 in 10 people. So what we're proposing is that since there's no cure for mitochondrial disease, that this would be a way of women that carry these mutations of having healthy children. And whilst I accept that it is not acceptable for some people, I think the vast majority of people in the UK, at least that's from the public surveys, would accept this as being ethically acceptable.
Well, if 1 in 10 people disagree with it in the UK, Dr. Doug Turnbull, I can almost guarantee you that a much higher percentage of people in the United States would disagree with this procedure if it ever comes here. But it's fascinating. That's Doug Turnbull, director of the Wellcome Trust Center for Mitochondrial Research at Newcastle University. Thank you, doctor.
Bye-bye.
Well, over the past few years, hydraulic fracturing, or fracking, you've heard of it, has become a boom industry, changing the employment landscape in Oklahoma, North Dakota, Wyoming, even out to Ohio, a whole bunch of states across the country. It's a method of extracting natural gas. And while industry experts point to fracking's potential for the for U.S. energy independence, some people are very concerned about the consequences for the environment, particularly groundwater. And it's for that reason that we go to Mora County, New Mexico, because it recently became the first county in the nation to ban fracking. Listen.
What we have left is our well water and our aquifers, and when the industry is wanting to come in and do any type of fracking or oil and gas extraction, you know, I think it was up to us as the people, as the government, the leadership here in our community to go ahead and pass an ordinance.
That's Mora County Commissioner John Alva speaking with Carrie Jung, reporter for KUNM in Albuquerque, and Carrie joins me now. Hi, Carrie.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Carrie Jung, it's good to have you. I want to start here with Ilberto Quintana. You spoke with him about Mora County's problems with drought, which plays directly into this issue of the quality of groundwater. Listen.
This is the first year I've ever seen it this bad. I've seen it where it stops for a little bit, then it comes back, but it didn't even start this year. It stayed dry, and it's been dry, and nothing's changing.
Carrie Jung, communities across the country are balancing the promise of new industry, new jobs, and a lot of economic growth with potential environmental damage. And it seems like in Mora County, New Mexico, that calculus is different than it would be in a place like Ohio.
Well, at least in Mora County, Gilberto, as well as many other residents in Mora County, are relying primarily on groundwater to survive right now. And so I think a lot of the residents there are just feeling like, you know, I'd rather not take the chance of polluting one of my only sources of clean water right now, especially when water in the way of rain and surface water is really hard to come by. There's another town here in New Mexico that actually has just run out of water. It's Magdalena. So I think town or residents are just saying, I'd rather not take the chance.
And when people would rather not take the chance, though, they also, of course, think about the other side of that equation that I mentioned, is which is, of course, they want jobs. Of course, they want income. Of course, they want industry. And it has to be a conflict with some people.
It is a conflict. John Olivas, the county council member that I spoke with, has estimated that about 95% of the residents are in support of the ban. However, you know, unemployment is really high in Mora County right now. It's about 13%, which is double the state average. So, you know, it is a balancing act there for sure. They really want their economy to be successful. But at the same time, I think they're also valuing their land and water assets as well.
These are, Carrie Jung, these are usually situations where you see industry, in this case, oil and gas drillers, hydrofracking companies and contractors, put up a big fight in city councils and county councils and state legislatures. Have they done so in this case? Have they put up a big fight against this ban?
In this case, not yet. However, it's unsure if this will hold up in court later on. Fracking has not yet moved into Mora County. Most of that has to do with the low price of natural gas right now. But the New Mexico Oil and Gas Association has told me that studies are showing there could be a significant amount of natural gas underneath the ground there. So when prices go up, as they're expecting they will, then we're thinking that the fracking industry might be a lot more vocal about it then. Mm.
So nobody really cares right now because prices are low and they haven't really done exploratory drilling. But if it becomes an economic plum, then the fight might really change there.
Yes, that's correct. Yeah, that's what industry experts are saying.
Right. Well, now that people in the town have decided to, you know, side on the side of environmental, I guess, protection and not industry, before we let you go here, are they optimistic about their dwindling water supply?
You know, everyone's always optimistic, especially when you're in the farming industry. But they still have a significant amount of groundwater that they're using. So, you know, they're surviving off of that, and we're just hoping for the best for next year.
Carrie Jung is reporter with KUNM in Albuquerque. She's been in Mora County, New Mexico, the first county in the country to ban hydrofracking, also known as fracking, for drilling for natural gas. Carrie, thank you so much.
Well, thank you.
Dad, are any of these movies good?
Worst episode ever.
I see a lot of films. I love all of them.
Your job is to rate movies on a scale from good to excellent.
Hated it.
Well, it's Friday. You're looking forward to the weekend, and that means it's movie day here on The Takeaway. We've got three movies in theaters this weekend, and we want you to know what to spend your money on and, more importantly, what not to waste your time on. First off, we'll talk about Channing Tatum saving the president, played by Jamie Foxx in White House Down. We've got a new crime action buddy comedy called The Heat. That's Sandra Bullock and Melissa McCarthy. And finally, we'll hear about the world of backup singers in 20 Feet from Stardom. As always, our Movie Date team, Rafer Guzman and Kristen Meinzer, are here to weigh in. Hi, guys.
Hi,
hey, Todd.
Hey, Todd.
Good to have you here. Of course, you can always subscribe to Kristen and Rafer's podcast at moviedatepodcast.org. Good to have you here.
Thanks.
Great to be here.
And as always, you're both looking at me because you are ready for trivia, and I'm getting those stares. Let's do trivia. Now, our top movie that we're going to review this week is White House Down. It was one in a long genre of White House movies. I want you to listen to this clip from what, in my opinion, is the greatest political slash White House movie ever made. This is an audio trivia this week. Listen to this clip. Don't answer. Identify this movie, please.
Mr. Garner, do you agree with Ben, or do you think we can stimulate growth through temporary incentives?
As long as the roots are not severed, all is well. In the garden.
In the garden?
Yes.
All right, now just keep it to yourself. I'm getting blank stares from Kristen Meinzer, which is exactly what I like. Raver's nodding, but we'll see if his confidence pays off there. All right, guys, keep it to yourself. Let's start off with what looks like this week's top release. This is White House Down with Channing Tatum and Jamie Foxx and Maggie Gyllenhaal. All right, let's listen to a clip.
I know you're into peace and all that. You got to stick that thing out there and go to work.
Damn right.
Hold it with two hands, President. There it goes.
I lost a rocket launcher.
You lost? How do you lose a rocket launcher?
Kristen Meinzer, I've been in the White House many times. It sounds nothing like that. Thank the Lord.
You clearly haven't seen enough White House movies. This movie just came out a few weeks ago, actually. It was called Olympus Has Fallen. This time it's called White House Down. Same premise. You have the White House under attack. You have a bodyguard who's trying to be in the Secret Service, who's trying to protect him. You have a child who's lost in all of this. And you have a question of, can they make it out alive?
Can they?
I don't want to give it all away. I can't give it all away.
If I see this in the theater, will I make it out alive is the question.
I have to say, I felt it was almost identical to Olympus Has Fallen, but I did enjoy Channing Tatum, and so I would give it just a little tiny bump for that. So it makes it a slightly better movie.
Rafer, Kristen says we've seen this movie before. Maybe you're thinking Die Hard. I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, Olympus Has Fallen was essentially a carbon copy of Die Hard. Here's the thing. I liked Die Hard, so I liked Olympus Has Fallen. And so I'm kind of hoping that, even though I haven't seen White House Down, I'm kind of hoping it'll be good.
Pizza's delicious. You always know what you're going to
exactly.
get. Exactly. All right. I want to move on to The Heat now. I want to stipulate at the top of this, I am a Sandra Bullock hater, not personally, just in terms of the theater. So I need to be convinced on this one. This is Sandra Bullock and Melissa McCarthy in The Heat. Listen.
Are you or are you not a narc? Like Johnny Depp in 21 Jump Street.
I see. Okay, a narc.
A narc, yes.
Yes, no.
What was I saying?
I was missing the R when you were saying, I heard narc.
What are you? What are you doing here? What are you doing?
I'm a federal agent. I'm a special agent.
Are you a boy or a girl?
It's a fair question.
I'm female.
No kidding.
All woman.
All right, Southie accents are funny, Rafer.
Yes, they are. Although I will say, Sandra Bullock is not really the funniest part of this film, although she is very endearing as this uptight federal agent. The real star of this film is Melissa McCarthy as the foul-mouthed Boston cop that
she was
teams
great in
up
this,
with.
She was great in This Is 40. She had a small part.
That's right. She's honing that volatile, angry, nasty character, sort of no class but all heart.
And she improvs a lot.
She improvs circles around everybody in this movie. I'm going to say I did not have huge expectations on this film, but I loved it. I think it's one of the funniest films I have seen in years. And Melissa McCarthy is just an absolute star. I feel like this is the movie that marks her arrival as like a real comedic star.
Well, Kristen, if I can't really stand to watch Sandra Bullock on a screen, can I still survive on Melissa McCarthy's performance?
Oh, you're going to love it. You are. Okay. I loved it. I went in, unlike Rafer, I went in with huge, high expectations because I love Melissa McCarthy. And unlike you, I actually like Sandra Bullock. But in addition to being just hilarious and funny and doing that same thing we're used to in cop buddy movies, we're mismatched. This is a comedy of mismatched people. I'm crazy. You're all business. It also has a heart, and I really enjoyed that my heart got a little bit warm and fuzzy at a few points.
All right. You've convinced me I may see this one, and maybe I'll just shade my eyes during the Sandra Bullock scene, but I may see this one. Now, Rafer, you saw a documentary called 20 Feet from Stardom about backup singers from Michael Jackson to Bruce Springsteen and a lot of other acts. Listen.
And then all of a sudden, we're on our way to rehearsal, and we get the news, and it's like, you got to be kidding me. Like, how's that even possible? We'll always be waiting, so somewhere in the end. Such an overwhelming shock just to go from almost on our way to this huge show to all of a sudden, he's gone.
Now, there's Judith Hill talking about Michael Jackson, of course. There are a lot of documentaries about the people unseen behind famous people. It's an interesting concept, backup singers.
Yeah, it is. The title basically refers to that short distance between their microphones in the back and the spotlight in the front. Yeah. They all want solo careers, but it's very difficult to have one as a backup singer. And the film interviews a lot of people who have been on famous tracks that you've heard, you know, all your life, but whose names you don't know. And it's a really interesting documentary about what it's like to struggle and want to be creative and do this work that you love and maybe not get rewarded for it. I thought it was a really wonderful film, uplifting, but also very real. And I really liked it a lot. I think, you know, and you don't have to be a music fan, I think, to enjoy it.
That movie is 20 Feet from Stardom, which gets a vote from Rafer Guzman. Okay, let's go to trivia before we end here. In the spirit of White House movies, I played you a clip from what I think is the greatest White House political movie ever made. Here's a refresher.
All is well. In the garden.
In the garden?
Yes.
Kristen Meinzer, what film is that?
I have absolutely no idea. I'm just going to say Dave. I have no idea.
Well, that is Peter Sellers playing Chauncey Gardner in, Rafer?
Being There.
Being There. 1979 Hal Ashby film starring Peter Sellers, Shirley MacLaine, an absolute must-see, the greatest political movie, in my opinion.
You're a cynic, Todd.
Ever made. Really? Not a fan. Okay. Well,
I love that movie, but it's a very cynical White House movie.
Yes, it is. And truly, truly great. It is cynical.
Yes.
And wonderful. Rafer Guzman and Kristen Meinzer are Movie Date team. Thanks, guys.
Thanks, Todd.
Well, this week at the Supreme Court is one that's going to have a lasting impact on the rights and freedoms of millions of Americans. And we thought it was a good time to take a moment to reflect on the health both of our democracy and struggles we see elsewhere in the world, from Turkey and Bulgaria to Brazil and maybe even what lies ahead in Cairo this week in Egypt. The language and the time zones change, but the voice of the protest is increasingly the same. Listen. Is this what democracy sounds like? Is this the sound of democracy in action? Or is it something far deeper? A response to a form of capitalism that's identified with the rule of unaccountable elites or a lack of accountability and aggressive policing? Well, Professor Alfred Stepan is the founding director of the Center for the Study of Democracy, Toleration, and Religion at Columbia University, and he joins me now.
Hello.
Well, thanks for coming in to join us, because this is a difficult time to understand in a place like Brazil. And let's start in Brazil, where we've seen a couple of weeks of protests now. On the surface, people protesting what they see as government corruption and a misuse of resources. They've got the Olympics and the World Cup coming, but I suspect it's about something maybe deeper than that. Where is this headed?
I think in Brazil, if it goes well, there's a chance that it's a protest against a huge corruption. It's a protest against the lack of social services. But in this case, the president has said, I hear you. I will try and make some changes. So she's been close to the group, and I would say 90% of the people demanding this want a deepening of a democracy, not an overthrow of democracy.
And she's very popular, so that's why you think this might be an actual democracy. You call it a democracy deepening event.
It could be a democracy deepening event, and I think it will be. She has, at the start of this, and 3 days into it, she still has 73% approval rating as president, and her government had a 65% approval rating. Most democracies in the world would die for those numbers.
Now, what exactly does democracy deepening mean by your definition? Does that mean that the will of the people is reflected? The people get upset. They take to the streets. Change is made. Is it as simple as that?
No, not. Because people could be demanding something that's not necessarily democratic, or they may have so many demands. But in this case, if she responds and recognizes that the corruption's been terrible, and if she does something as an executive about this, and the next presidential election, which will be next year, is run on the issue of fighting corruption, it could end up in democratic deepening.
Now, of course, we're talking about Dilma Rousseff, who's the president of Brazil, yes, as you mentioned, with a 73% approval rating, go across the ocean and to the northern hemisphere to Turkey, where Prime Minister Erdogan is confronting what seems to be a pretty different situation. Now, on the face of it, people were upset over the reapportioning of a park and what they saw as sort of oppressive, anti-democratic government action. But it seems like a far different situation there.
You're absolutely right, Todd. It's far different. In the one sense, Erdogan has been prime minister for 11 years. He's won three free and fair elections. So at that level, it's a democracy. On the other hand, he's an immensely polarizing person. About 50% of the people can't stand him because they're secularists and they're terrified he's going to take them in the direction of Iran. He is much more polarizing than President Dilma in Brazil. And the opposition is more polarizing, in my judgment, because worse comes to worse. If Erdogan pushes further with the coercion and tries to use the military, I think the military could revolt against him and we'd be back. This is a country that had military coups in 1950, 1960, 1971, 1981. The current constitution was drafted by the military. So the polarization there is dangerous.
We're on a survey now. And before we move to the Middle East, which I want to do because this is fascinating, take a second to look at ourselves here because it's inevitable. We have to compare our own democracy, which we're very proud of, with these younger democracies in Turkey and in Brazil of their various levels of deepening. We're in a polarized moment now in America, and yet despite rhetoric, nobody's really afraid that we're headed for a terribly anti-democratic moment or a moment when the democracy would be undermined by protests. We had Tea Party protests in 2010, which in a way seem to be democratically deepening. More people are being heard. Now, Congress is polarized, but you can hear me. I'm trying to digest where we are on the spectrum of democratic deepening that you're talking about here.
Well, then we can talk about Occupy Wall Street, too. These are big movements. I think that the reason why the polarization is less democratically dangerous is because people aren't thinking of non-constitutional outcomes, or they're not thinking of how they can change the Constitution. And what we have to realize is that Turkey's Constitution is one of the easiest in the world to change. It just takes one vote by 66% of the people in the parliament, and that's there, and they've close to having 66% of the seats.
Easy
the United
enough.
States one is the hardest constitution in any democracy to change. It takes the Senate, it takes the lower house, it takes the president, and it takes two-thirds of the state by two-thirds majority. The ranking of it, it's the hardest. So we're not facing any non-democratic constitutional change. That's off the agenda. And what we are, I personally have recently done a study of the 22 long-standing democracies. On three of the most important indicators, every single one of them, the United States has the highest ratio of inequality. So I think we should have more demands for transparency, better equality, and it's amazing that people haven't really pushed hard for this. So I'm for democratic deepening, even in the United States, in this case, equality deepening, not democratic deepening as much.
Well, there may be a whole other discussion to have about how democratic or transparent this bright star of democracy that we live in really is. But maybe we'll leave that because I do want to go to the Middle East.
I'll just say 30 seconds on the United States. No other long-standing democracy has anything which allows one person to stop a vote in the Senate by a filibuster, and now it doesn't even have to give his name. It can be a silent filibuster. This is incredibly undemocratic.
Well, you're right in my wheelhouse there in the United States Senate. I did want to ask you about that. I didn't want to side. I'm glad you said that. It is fascinating. Now, in a place, however, and I do want to go to the Middle East, like Egypt, and comparing it to Tunisia, two countries. We have to talk about the Arab Spring and the aftermath of the Arab Spring. Two countries there who've reacted differently to their own protests, and we're coming up on a one-year anniversary of Mohamed Morsi in Egypt. There are, again, protests planned there. And I wonder what your, maybe not prognosis, but what your diagnosis of democratic depth in Egypt is right now, and then we'll touch on Tunisia.
I've been to Egypt 3 times since the Arab Spring, and I've been to Tunisia 5 times. Right from the very beginning, I said the chances of a democratic transition in Egypt were vastly less, partly because the secularists were much more like Turkey. They were much more interested in blocking any Islamist group than they were in necessarily creating a democracy. But the Democrats, I mean the Muslims who won the majority, they also had a whole series of undemocratic parts in their platform. So both sides had slightly undemocratic elements, so both of them wanted the military to come in on their side. So that's the military last week said this Sunday, if things got out of control, they implied they might reassume power.
Right.
Tunisia had something that's totally different. They've had free and fair elections, which everyone viewed and said were free and fair. I think they'll approve the Constitution, I hope, in December. I feel there'll be free and fair elections after it. And I think that the Islamist Party, the moderate Islamist Party, will not be in head of the coalition, but they will accept being a junior member of the coalition. Or I actually believe they would accept being out of power. This would be huge.
Well, as we look at protests around the world, from Egypt to Brazil, Tunisia to Turkey, Professor Alfred Stepin says, think about democratic deepening. He is Wallace Sayre Professor of Government, the founding director of the Center for the Study of Democracy, Toleration, and Religion at Columbia University. Professor, thank you.
Thank you. It's been marvelous.
Thanks for listening to the Takeaway Podcast. Tell us what you think of it by leaving us a review on iTunes or by letting us know on Twitter or Facebook.